where you first get a difference is such that it's coldest at the pole. That has the effect of sucking air downward at the pole. The air that is considerably above that gets caught up in that suction and gets compressed so much that it ends up being heated hotter than the rising air at the same height above the equator. If I could show you a pork chop diagram for farther down the atmosphere, way below the clouds, you would see that it is indeed coldest at the pole. But as I mentioned, we have the same thing above the poles in the Earth at comparable heights. Okay, I realize it sounds like sort of pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, but the key to understanding it is the fact that the air is so much less dense at higher heights than it is at lower heights, that the stuff at higher heights, if it's being affected by the stuff at lower heights at all, is going to be affected irregardless of what it wants to do. It's just going to get sucked down in that circulation. Okay, here are pie diagrams showing the percentages of various gases in the atmosphere of Venus as determined by the preliminary determination from the Large Probe gas chromatograph. This is the diagram for Earth, and this is the diagram for Mars. And if you look at the numbers for Earth, you will find that they do not add up to 100%. They add up to 101%. And the reason for that was, this is from my article in the February issue of the magazine Sky and Telescope, and it was put out in a great hurry. They had very little time between the time I mailed them the manuscript and the time they put it out. And apparently Kelly Beattie, the editor, did not notice that I had given him numbers for dry air. In other words, for air minus the water vapor, because the water vapor varies. And then told him that the water vapor could be as much as 1%. And so he used my dry air numbers and added in 1% for water vapor, and it adds up to 101%. Other than that, however, the diagram is fine. Now remember, these are percentages of whatever amount of air the planet has. But please remember that Venus has almost 100 times as much air as the Earth has, and the Earth has 200 times as much air as Mars has. So don't compare those areas. If you want to know how much carbon dioxide Venus has, it should be some enormous circle that has 100 times the area of this Earth circle, and the whole Mars circle ought to be some tiny little thing with 200 the size of that. We actually thought about presenting the data in those forms, and you know, very quickly realized there's simply no way you could fit it all on the page. You know, there was no scale that you could use that would show both the great big circle you would need for Venus and the tiny little circle you would need for Mars, so we just printed it this way. But what you can see, I think, is that the Martian atmosphere and the Venus atmosphere are extremely similar to one another. Both of them are mostly carbon dioxide. In both cases, the next gas is nitrogen, which dominates the air on Earth by default. Remember from last time, our air would be mostly carbon dioxide if it were not for all those things that happened in our planet's history. And the third most common gas on all three planets is argon, which is just about the same percentage of Mars and Earth, and is there. We ought to get any more argon here. The argon number for Venus ought to be somewhat similar to that for Mars. So, in fact, the three planets have atmospheres that are very similar if you can ignore, number one, the oxygen, which is the second most common gas in the atmosphere of Earth, but that's only because of photosynthesis, which obviously hasn't happened yet through Mars. Number two, the fact that the Earth ought to have huge amounts of carbon dioxide in addition to what you're seeing here, and so that would turn these big percentages into tiny little numbers like this. And number three, the fact that none of these diagrams shows what is actually the most common outgassing product, and that is water. Water has liquefied on Earth, it has frozen on Mars, and we have a great deal of evidence that a lot of Mars is underlain by permafrost, frozen water in the soil, and in fact about 80% of the surface of Mars is underlain by permafrost. And on Venus, well, we don't have the water. And I went through the controversy last time about why that is. Yeah?
I thought there were large amounts of
argon. Well, were you here last time? Okay. The amount of radiogenic argon on Venus, not the percentage, okay, the amount. Remember, these show you percentages of whatever amount of gas you have. You talked about how many billion tons of stuff there is. The amount of radiogenic argon, that is to say argon 40, is just about equal to the amount that is present in the atmosphere of the Earth. In addition, however, you have this surprising discovery that there is a roughly equal amount of primeval argon, of argon 36, on Venus, whereas there is virtually none on Earth and even less on Mars. So if you consider total argon, 36 plus 40, Venus has twice as much as Earth. Okay? If you consider them separately, Venus has the same amount of argon 40 as Earth. By the way, the fact that Venus has the same amount of radiogenic noble gases, that is, noble gases produced by radioactivity, as the Earth does, implies that Venus has the same amount of radioactivity inside its rock. So we're actually doing geology here, not just meteorology. In other words, Venus should have about the same level of geologic activity as the Earth. You don't expect Venus to be enormously more volcanically active, for instance, or to have much stronger continental drift kinds of processes than the Earth does. You expect them to be roughly similar, based on that indication. It is radioactivity which powers, the heat generated by radioactivity, that powers geologic processes on any planet like ours. Now, at this point, you see, the reason that I had the slides arranged in this particular order is at this point that I was going to go into the big, long discussion about why Venus' atmosphere is the way it is, that in, and then the whole, leading up to the whole argon thing, which in fact we got into last time. So let me just show you these other slides, which I brought along to illustrate the point very rapidly. Here's a picture of outgassing in process. This is a Skylab photograph of Mount Etna, the most active volcano in Europe, the highest volcano in Europe. It's on the island of Sicily, and you can see, this is during the eruption, this is 270 miles up, you can see it very, very clearly. There is molten lava traveling down the side of the mountain, and there is a plume of escaping steam. These clouds are not related to the eruption. They are orographic clouds, which is to say the wind is blowing in this direction, as you can see from the steam plume also, and as it goes up over the mountain, it is expanded and therefore cooled, and all of a sudden it gets to the point where it can no longer hold all the moisture and clouds develop. That's very common on the downwind side of any mountain. Here is a picture of a piece of limestone, which I think will convince you that it is made of shells. And I deliberately did not pick a spectacular museum quality piece. This is a very ordinary chunk of limestone, which I found in a gravel pit in Ann Arbor. And you could find one in any gravel pit in this area of the country with 5 minutes of searching. It looks very much like this chock full of shells. The area between the shells, the matrix of this particular limestone, is calcium carbonate also. It may be microscopic shells, which don't show the scale of the picture, there's a dime to scale, or it may be that it's calcium carbonate, which is not now fossil, but that's because calcium carbonate is a very common material as a result of so much of it having been produced by living things on the Earth. And it also happens to be, of all the major rock-forming minerals, the one that is most easily dissolved in water. And so there's a lot of the stuff now in the groundwater of the Earth. And it's constantly being evaporated out as solid calcium carbonate that shows no hint of the shells that it originally was. Here's a nice example of that. This is a piece of limestone that I photographed in a gravel pit in Wyoming. You see, I spent a fair amount of my time in gravel pits. The limestone itself is the dark stuff, and then it cracks, and water seeps in and carries some calcium carbonate with it, and then the water evaporated, and so in the crack, you have pure calcium carbonate that has been deposited. So it's a very pretty stone as a result, but it's all limestone, and the reason for the different colors is different degrees of impurity. There's a certain amount of organic material, and organic material has a lot of carbon in it, and so when it decays, it turns sedimentary rocks black, and coal, of course, is a fine example of that. Okay, at this point, I find, to my exceeding amazement, that I have an entire half hour left, because I've run out of slides, which means I'm actually going to be able to talk about some things that I didn't think I'd have time for. So, if we can have the lights up, I want to tell you first about the ionosphere of Venus, and should I have more faith in myself or something, I actually have slides to illustrate this, and I didn't include them in my tray. I will bring them in next week, and I will show them to you at the end of the lecture, and go through them very rapidly, and you'll remember from this week what they were. No, I won't talk about the ionosphere first. I want to talk about the homosphere and the heterosphere. The atmosphere of a planet consists of a bunch of different kinds of gases, some of which are lighter and some of which are heavier than others. And so you might think that since these are all fluids, that they would all cheerfully separate out from one another by weight, and the highest or the heaviest one would form a layer around the bottom, and suffocate us all because the heaviest one in the Earth's atmosphere is not oxygen, and then the others would form shells of decreasing density further out. It happened with the once liquid material, which is now mostly solid inside the Earth, immediately after the Earth formed, it melted. The heaviest stuff, namely the iron, fell to the center, formed the iron core. The lightest stuff floated up to the top, and that's the crust we walk around on. And the interior structure of the Earth is shells of different densities going down toward the iron core. Consider the fact that most of the Earth's gold is 1,800 miles below your feet in the core, because that's how you do it when it went along the iron. So, what does the same thing have in the planetary atmosphere? Well, it does not in the lower part of the atmosphere where the overwhelming majority of the gas is. And the reason is that there is enough circulation, of vertical circulation, convection and other forms of vertical circulation, that stirs them all back together again. And so if you look at tables, so the atmospheric composition of the Earth, such and such percentage of nitrogen, such and such of oxygen, and so on, those numbers are exactly the same everywhere over the surface of the Earth and everywhere in the atmosphere up to a height of something like 50 miles. But above that height, which is called the turbo pond, above that height, the atmosphere does indeed separate out into layers of different density. And so if you go high enough in the atmosphere of the Earth, you will find layers where the air is made of very different things, or the same things in very different proportions than you are used to down here on the surface. So you can broadly divide the atmosphere of any planet into two regions. The homosphere on the bottom, homo means same, that's where the composition is the same all the way around and all up. And then the heterosphere, hetero means different, above, where you have layers of different substances. Well, the slide that I was showing you, and I will show you next week, I didn't think I was going to have time for this, shows the number of molecules of various atoms, the number of molecules of various gases per cubic centimeter graphed as a function of height. And of course, as you go up, all of them decrease. Well, up to a certain height, all of them decrease at exactly the same rate. And that means, if you think about it for a moment, that all the lines of the chart are parallel. Okay? You can visualize what I'm doing here with my hand. I've got a number of molecules down here versus height up here. Okay? And so they're all parallel up to a certain height. That height is the turbo pond. And then all of a sudden, they start, none of them turn around, but they start decreasing at different rates because some of them are heavier than others and therefore tend to fall down toward the turbo pond. And so what happens is the turbo pond is at a certain height. I don't remember what that height is, but it's on the graph. But it is a height that was measured only by the pond. The ugly duckling is a mission, the one that was supposed to be just something intended to get thrown there. The fact that the bus survived that extra 5 miles meant that it was the only one of all the pioneers in this spacecraft which measured the height of the turbopause, of the maximum density of the ions in the ionosphere, which I'll explain in a moment, and of the exobase, which is the bottom of the region of the atmosphere from which molecules can escape into space if they're moving fast enough, in other words, their ions. All three of those important levels happen to be at just about the same level on Venus, by coincidence. They are very spread out from one another on Earth. And all three were penetrated only by the bus. The probe did not start measuring, it go much further down, and the orbiter does not get that far down to the atmosphere. So it's all about come down from beyond the circle. Well, as you walk above this, to the turbo pond, of course, the overwhelmingly most abundant material is carbon dioxide. What happens then is, above that, you have a layer where carbon dioxide is still the most important gas that's falling off very rapidly with height, because it is so heavy, and therefore concentrated so much down toward the bottom. At a certain height, another gas takes over. What that gas is monatomic oxygen. Oxygen, single atom. You've never seen that on Earth, or rather you've seen only indirectly on Earth. Because at the pressures that we have here at the surface of the Earth, the oxygen, you can see oxygen molecules are ferociously reactive. They are among the probably half dozen most violently reactive substances known in chemistry. And they will combine with anything that they can oxidize very, very rapidly. That is the reason, for example, hydrogen peroxide is such a good bleach and such a good disinfectant. Hydrogen peroxide molecule consists of an oxygen molecule, H2O, right? Two atoms of hydrogen, one atom of oxygen, plus another atom of oxygen, so it's H2O2. And that's not a terribly stable configuration. It's very easy to knock that other oxygen off. In fact, if you put hydrogen peroxide sit around the table, it happens spontaneously. The single oxygen atom self-generated then attack anything they can get their hands on, for example, bacteria, and that's why it's a good disinfectant, or dyes, and that's why it's a good bleach, and hydrogen peroxide that you might use to bleach your hair, for example, is very impure, it's almost all water. And if you put anything like pure hydrogen peroxide on your hair, it'll last through your whole day. let's say that you would become dissolved in your work, leave it at that. So, single oxygen is very, very reactive. And the reason that you don't see it on Earth is that if you were to split apart an oxygen molecule, say, immediately the two of them would recombine with one another, or if you split apart several oxygen molecules, they'd probably switch around and recombine with each other, and you just don't have single oxygen. But the density up above the turbo pond is so large that you can actually have large amounts of monatomic oxygen, expressed percentage-wise, because the atoms are so far apart that they can't get together again. Well, carbon dioxide consists of one atom of carbon and two atoms of oxygen, hence the name, that's CO2. Ultraviolet light from the sun will come in and will split a carbon dioxide molecule into CO, that's carbon monoxide, and a monatomic oxygen atom. Okay? You have a certain amount of CO in the upper atmosphere, but it never dominates. It's pretty heavy, too. And at all heights where it's significant, there's so much more carbon dioxide around the heavens would get that, in fact, the carbon dioxide dominates. But as you go to a certain height, the carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide fall off so rapidly that there is actually a range of heights in the upper atmosphere of Venus where the most abundant material is monatomic oxygen atoms, which are looking for somebody to recombine with. You would think that they would simply recombine with the carbon monoxide. They don't. The reason for that is, well, I have to go through a lot of common sense. There's something called a forbidden transition, which doesn't mean what it sounds like. It's not something totally possible. It is something that is very, very unlikely to happen. It takes a long time before it does happen. And if there's any competing reaction that happens faster, the competing reaction will happen at this. And that happens in the upper atmosphere of Venus. When you split on Mars, same as it goes with Mars, because that also is a mostly carbon dioxide atmosphere. Well, if you split apart by ultraviolet the carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide and oxygen, what happens overwhelmingly is the monatomic oxygen atoms combine, not with the carbon monoxide, but with each other, to form oxygen molecule, O2. That is very, very interesting. Because carbon monoxide is a stable gas, and oxygen molecules are a stable gas. And on both planets, Venus and Mars, you would expect this process, we know the carbon dioxide comes from the sun, you would expect this process to turn the entire carbon dioxide atmosphere into an atmosphere of carbon monoxide plus molecular oxygen in a time of only a few million years. Clearly, it would not happen on either planet. Why? Well, in the case of Mars, we know the reason. There's a catalyst in the atmosphere, a substance that is present in very small amounts, but that is capable of speeding up the reaction in which the oxygen molecule is broken apart and a single oxygen combined with the carbon monoxide to the point where it can happen rapidly if the catalyst is there. A catalyst is a substance whose presence speeds up a chemical reaction, but which does not itself get destroyed in a chemical reaction. That may sound like a weird thing, but believe me, you wouldn't be alive if it didn't exist. Your whole life, everything, the biochemistry that allows you to exist, is made possible only because you are chock full of catalysts, which are enable reactions to keep you going to happen with very little energy input and to happen at a slow, controlled rate. After all, the only difference between you and a fire that is burning up a log, oxidation goes both places, right? You're oxidizing the foods that you ate right now with the oxygen you're breathing. And the only difference between those is it takes a lot of energy to get a fire going, right? You've got to strike a match. Amount of energy prohibited for a biochemical system. But it then gives you a tremendous amount of energy back, which would also be prohibited with a toy. The truth on fire would kill you. You know, instead, you're doing it at a very low rate, controlled rate, because of the enzyme. The enzyme is a biological catalyst. That's all an enzyme is, a catalyst that involves in biochemistry. It is not a serious substance, not only detergent, free water soap, it is a toy. Getting back to the upper atmosphere of Mars, there is a catalyst, and that catalyst is hydrogen peroxide. We know that hydrogen peroxide exists in tiny quantities, but it doesn't do the job on Mars. On Venus, for various technical reasons that I will not go into, these are too technical, that means I understand later, you do not expect hydrogen peroxide to be present in major quantities. For one reason, very simple, it's a lot there, hydrogen peroxide would have broken up. And so, the question, one of the major puzzles of Venus, before finding Venus, was, why hasn't that planet's atmosphere been turned into carbon monoxide or molecular oxygen? Presumably the answer is that some other substance that there is a catalyst. But we do not know what that other substance is. Now, and we're hoping to find out eventually from analysis of the Pioneer Venus composition data. But so far, to the best of my knowledge, I'm too worried about data on this, but so far, to the best of my knowledge, nobody figured out where it is.
Well, if there
are
these temperatures on moving atmosphere, right, really, that implies that there's practically no.
Vertical mixing. Either there is practically no vertical mixing or much more likely, because there are vertical winds in measurement. They're gentle, but they're there. The processes that maintain that incredible complexity and diversity in the cloud layers happen more rapidly over a more rapid time scale than mixing does. So we try to mix the clouds together and they fall right back apart into that thing you're putting up.
Upper
atmosphere. The thing is, there's major composition in the upper atmosphere, and it is not so. It is a dominantly carbon dioxide atmosphere up to the level above the thermoclouds where the carbon dioxide just, falls off to almost nothing, and molecular oxygen takes over. But by day, you're down to such a low density that of the thermoclouds, virtually all of it is the carbon dioxide region. Of the portion above the carbon dioxide region, virtually all of it is the molecular oxygen, and so on. And so on, because the density is falling up so rapidly. So it doesn't work, the numbers don't work. Something else I just point out too, because I was asked a question about this earlier. Some of the oxygen lasts long enough that it drifts around on the night side before it recombines. When it recombines to form molecular oxygen, it emits light, a characteristic wavelength, which we can observe. And we can fact, well, we can't, as a matter of fact. Our spectrometer on the orbiter is not sensitive to these wavelengths. But on the Venera 910 orbiter, the Russians had spectrometers that were, and they measured this glow produced by the production of molecular oxygen in the upper atmosphere. This is really spectacular. You could stand on Venus and work at the clouds and watch the oxygen forming from the ground. Does it glow?
Is there a heat
from that? I can't say no, but not enough to be significant. Because you're dealing with such low density compared to lower atmosphere. We're talking about upper atmosphere here, and it's practically decoupled from the lower atmosphere just because the density is so terribly, terribly low. So, there is heat that is significant in that layer. But there is not heat that is significant in the lower atmosphere. That is not what is making the surface temperature 900 degrees. Yeah, well, what's making the surface temperature 900 degrees is the greenhouse effect. I did explain greenhouse effect last week, right? Yeah, greenhouse effect from the carbon dioxide aged and embedded by the sulfuric, by the sulfur dioxide in the water. And quite possibly aided by compression of the atmosphere in those places in the atmospheric circulation where the air is intended. There's going to be more heat generated by compression than there's going to be cooling generated by air rising and expanding, because after all, gravity is on the side of being pulled down. Okay. So, the weight of the atmosphere on the surface? It's almost 100 square inches. So if you figure out the number of square inches on the surface of Venus and multiply it by 10, you probably got it. It's going to be roughly 200 million square miles on the surface of Venus, because that's how many there are on the Earth, it's about the same size. And it's something you order 10 to 15 times. Why? Or did you just want to know? The upper atmosphere is so thin that the upper atmosphere is an awful big distance above the lower atmosphere. You get to one Earth atmosphere pressure in the cloud layer, and you've still got 30 miles to go before you hit the ground. And it compresses very, very, very rapidly as you go down. Half the Earth's atmosphere is within 3 miles of the surface. And the same number is roughly true for Venus. It's not the exact same number. I don't remember what the number is for Venus. But it's within a few miles of the surface. So that's where it all happens. Yeah, that's your really high temperatures are only in the last few miles. That's why the balloon experiment is going to work. So you can get remarkably close to the surface. Say 10 miles up, 15 miles up, and still not be all that hot. Well, I hope maybe I've given you too much of an impression of how dense the atmosphere is. It is about 1/8 as dense as water at the surface, so it's not as though the probe is going to explode and not be able to go further. The way you will see when the Galileo probe goes into Jupiter, it will get down to a certain height and there's a good chance it will float by a certain depth. It may be destroyed before that, but there's a good chance it will actually penetrate to a depth where it will float. But you don't see it on Venus, it doesn't get back there. It's about 1/8 as dense as water. Okay, let's see, where was I? Oh yeah, this generates oil. Well, for centuries, there have been sporadic observations of a light, a very dim light, coming from the night side of Venus, the ashen light of Venus. I have been privileged to see it once in my life in 1957, and that was a time of high solar activity, and there seems to be a correlation between observations of the ashen light and solar activity. It seems to happen around high solar activity. And the question I was asked was, do we know anything about the ashen light, in particular for this recombination light of the formation of oxygen molecules be it? The answer is, in the intensities the Russians observed, no, but the Russians were there about the time of solar minimum. We're there about the time of solar maximum. The problem is we don't have a spectrometer which is capable of observing the same frequency. We can fake it. We can figure it out from the frequencies in Canada. So far, I have not heard anything that suggests, however, that we've got any explanation for the ashen light from Pioneer Venus Day. But I have not asked that specific question of anybody for several months. It's possible that if I talk to the OUDS principal experimenter, orbiter, ultraviolet, spectrometer, principal experimenter,
tiny amount of light compared to what the effort is out. Now on Earth, that lightning extends out for over 10,000 miles. We have the same structure. We have the same three layers above our lowest layer of the thermopause they have on Venus. That is to say, up to the thermopause, the dominant gas is nitrogen. There's a layer above the thermopause where the dominant gas is still nitrogen. Then you have one where it's molecular oxygen. Then you have one where it's helium. And then you have one where it's hydrogen. The hydrogen extends out over 10,000 miles from the surface of the Earth. It's been photographed from the moon in the light of the ultraviolet radiation that it emits. And I will show you that slide next time. And you'll see a huge photograph of the surface of the moon, Apollo 15. You can't see it from underneath because these wavelengths are absorbed by the atmosphere, but so I would have a capacitor on the way down from the upper atmosphere down where we are. But you can photograph it from the outside. And it turns out that hydrogen geocorona, so-called, the uppermost region, is enormously bigger on Earth than it is on Venus. And the reason for that is that although the lower atmosphere of Venus is very much hotter than Earth, the upper atmosphere of Venus is very much colder than Earth. Therefore, the gas is not as expanded. The hydrogen in the outer part of the heterosphere is heated not by the sun, but by heat coming up from the lower part of the heterosphere, where it is mostly carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide, just because it does have such a good greenhouse effect, is very efficient at radiating away heat. And so you expect a planet with a dominantly carbon dioxide atmosphere to have a cold upper atmosphere, and indeed you see that on both Venus and Mars. Much colder than at the same level above the surface of the Earth, therefore much smaller than the Earth. Get out of here. An ion is an atom from which one or more electrons have been removed by X-ray and extreme ultraviolet radiation from the sun, in this case. I mean, the general definition of ion is an atom from which electrons have been either removed or added by any process. But what we're talking about here is atoms from which electrons have been removed, and the electrons, you think, would just join right back with the atom. But in the lower atmosphere, they do. But in the upper atmosphere, the density is so low that, again, the electrons cannot recombine for a long time. And so you have a layer in the upper atmosphere where there are ionized atoms, atoms that have lost electrons, and the electrons searching around, hoping to find atoms to recombine with. But at a given moment, there's a population of these ions and electrons. Well, the point is, both of those are charged particles. Therefore, they reflect radio waves. We can bounce radio waves off the Earth's ionosphere over the horizon to a place hundreds of thousands of miles away, if they are the right frequencies. Not all frequencies do this, but AM frequencies, for example, do. FM frequencies do not. That is why you can pick up New Orleans every night, WWL, on your AM radio, but you cannot pick up even Ohio on your FM radio. Okay, on Southern Ohio, say, on your FM radio, or go over the horizon. Well, the Earth's ionosphere has several different waves. And the reason for that is that the ionosphere, the region where the ions are, is in the heterosphere. And so different gases are ionized at different heights. And you have four different layers of ions in the Earth's ionosphere. It is the bottommost one that will reflect our radio wave off. Now, remember that the density of the gas falls off rapidly as you go up. The lowest layer of the Earth's ionosphere is low enough. Therefore, the air is dense enough that the electrons and the ions take only a few hours to recombine if you turn off the sunlight. And every night, the sunlight is turned off. And so as the Earth's rotation carries the lower layers of the Earth's ionosphere onto the place where there's no sun to create new ions and the old ones recombine, the ionosphere goes away. The electrons recombine with the ions, and there is no new population of ions and electrons created to replace them until that part of the atmosphere gets out in the sunlight again the next morning. So every night, 2 hours after sunset, the ionosphere above your head goes, the lower layers go away. The upper layers, however, are so much lower in density that it takes them more than an entire Earth night to recombine. So the upper layer is still there. Effect? Here's the Earth. Here is the lower part of the atmosphere was there only the daytime. Here is New Orleans, here is you. New Orleans broadcast like this, comes down here, doesn't mean you. Okay? Let that go away at night. Only the higher layer there, the signal goes up, goes much farther distance, and hits you. I should put you over there on my elbow. Okay? That is why you can hear distant radio signals at night. Well, Venus takes 243 days to turn around once. Well, Venus takes 243 days to turn around one. And even as cloudy as it
say 40 terawatts. And in that time, you would expect the ionosphere would go up. And that was one of the major shocks from early space exploration of Venus. Look at all the events of ionosphere. Yeah, ionosphere would have discovered that. But there was a nice-sized ionosphere on Venus. We do not understand what it is that maintains it through the night. One possibility is that a meteor coming from outer space and burning up the upper atmosphere of Venus, and they're burning up just about that height of the ionosphere. The metal atoms that they leave behind, iron in particular, are very long lives when they're ionized, and it may be the next time ionosphere consists of metal atoms. Have a theory for by your Venus. Wrong. Not sure. The next time ionosphere, well, iron of Venus discovered the metal ions, but there are not enough of them to keep the ionosphere going through the night. The other version of Venus. Pioneer Venus orbiter also discovered. Remember, it didn't have in the upper atmosphere. Every time it goes around Venus. Pioneer Venus orbiter also discovered that the ionosphere of the night sky again exists as patches. It only exists sometimes. The whole thing seems to go away every once in a while. And then the next day, the next Earth day, remember the orbiter goes around Venus once every Earth day. The next Earth day comes back, and there's the ionosphere again going away. At first, it was something old in the ionosphere. But the belief now is all our atmosphere goes away from it. On the night side. It is when the orbiter is closest to the planet, when closest to the planet happens to be over the night side, and one of these days occurs on which the night side atmosphere is gone, that the orbiter is able to hear the radio signal, the terror, from the light from a further below. Terrors will be bounced off the night side atmosphere when it's there. They are ordinary cities, and we really want to amp. But sometimes there's no answer to this because you hear the. So the first point to try to do radio communication is on a planet like Venus at night. You never know what you will get through or not.
You
don't get
three
night operations. Doesn't seem to be. There's been any pattern to it so far. The problem is, you can only measure this sort of thing when you're actually passing through the ionosphere. There are only 50 series of time lasting for about a couple months at a time when the carrier closest approach to the planet is above the night side instead of being above the day side. So remember what we use the pattern is just complex enough that because of the sporadic nature of that data, we don't have any answer yet. But so far, it's just kind of pattern.
If an atmosphere like this,
it's
suitable for that
kind of new atmosphere. Probably would be if it went for all that sulfuric acid, the decomposition product. The sulfur dioxide and so forth. Oh, I see, the atmosphere above the clouds. Oh, it's awfully cold up there. Even the clouds are up to 154 zero Fahrenheit. No, that's good. That means an awful lot of overlap. Well, I'll put that in satellite something even if it's still together. It's an interesting thought. Carl Sagan did once, after he discovered how hard it is on the surface, beautiful with some of the papers that affected the could be oil. Floating clouds of Venus. Then we found out the clouds of Venus were made of concentrated sulfuric acid. And you know, I don't think they were really believed. He just got in the literature to cover all possible.
What you said is so
logical
that
the
Earth was
like both types rather than the surface. Well, I guarantee you, whatever originated on Venus had a short and unhappy career. because of the temperature. Remember, it may take a while for the Venus to build up to the point where the temperature was high enough, or was high enough to sustain it. In fact, if you want to argue that Venus once had an ocean, and the calcium carbonate formed in that ocean, the same way it did here, so for a long time, you didn't have much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you can't disprove that. What would have happened is, if Venus is close to the sun, and since the water vapor was still coming out of the volcano, the time finally would have come when the temperature of Venus got above the boiling point of water. And when that happened, the ocean would have boiled. That, in turn, would have destroyed the calcium carbonate, would have turned back in the calcium salt and carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide would have been just getting the greenhouse. So we're destroying all the others that happen. If you finally want to claim that light is uniform in that ocean, go right ahead. You know, we can't disprove, of course, we're destroyed at this point. Now, there are some very old geographic features, some geologic features on Venus. So this happened, very, very early in Venus history. There are craters that must be 3 and 4 billion years old, near Earth. And the fact that those survived, those would have been destroyed by find as much money in water, as it has been destroyed on the Earth, for the Earth to be all the Earth. I don't know, I haven't been able to address this particular question. My suspicion is that the low temperature and the ultraviolet and what residual conspire to prevent the formation of the mechanism, but I am not an organic chemist. Believe me, I am not. And astronomers, I've never had a chemistry course in my life, and astronomers' education is conducted on the assumption that the entire universe is just a monatomic gas. With a very close approximation, it does. Most of the universe is either interior to stars or interstellar matter, both of which are overwhelmingly monatomic gases. When you get into these strange, weird places like planets, you need enough chemistry, and, you know, I just don't really know enough to be able to get a good answer to a question like that. We're sort of officially finished the lecture since it's 9:30, so we've got about 10 minutes we can hang around and ask questions, and we've all got to be out of here again. Well, the upper atmosphere, the middle atmosphere, the atmosphere around the fundraiser, we have no idea what I'd be calling the upper atmosphere, what kind of circulation there. Finding a vehicle will figure that out. How could the crater persist with that atmosphere? How did they form that atmosphere? Easy. A meteorite that's going to form a crater 50 miles across, 100 miles across, 150 miles across, isn't even going to notice that atmosphere on the way in. If the meteorite is smaller than about 200 feet across, it will be destroyed on the way in. If a 15 miles in diameter of a region, a mean atmosphere is not going to stop in the ocean. So, of course, we're not going to stop. A lot of people cheerfully believe the region will be crazy here because the meteorites all burn out in the atmosphere. It's hard. Only tiny.
Qualitative analysis on your part. Barring any of your own bias in favor or against, barring any Soviet American claims, what does the new data on the say to terraforming of this new
data? Oh, I think much they didn't know already. Maybe it's because we don't know how to terraform enough detail that, you know, you worry about the kind of level of detail this is showing you. See, Pioneer Venus was unlike the Voyagers in a whole lot of respects, of course, but one of them is that it was not a first visit to a new world about which we knew very little. It was a third generation spacecraft going back to a planet, the bulk growth data from which we already had. Which, of course, is one reason it was given less coverage in the media. You know, it's easier, I think, for a reporter who doesn't have much science background to respond to brand new investigation of absolutely virgin territory the way you had with the moons of Jupiter and Voyager 1 than, well, here we go back to Venus again, even though we learned far more about Venus from Pioneer Venus than all the earlier ones put together. But it was detailed. I can't think of anything. You know, we don't know in detail how to terraform a planet. If we did, you know, if you got to the point where you were dealing with quantitative numbers and so on, then sure, Pioneer Venus would be just the kind of thing you want. But I don't know if they ever terraformed a planet. Terraform to alter the planet by doing things to its atmosphere or by doing things to its surface or both in such a way as to make it more like the Earth. For example, for Venus, okay, what's the problem with living in Venus? A, it's too hot, B, the atmosphere is too dense, C, it rotates so slowly, and so you don't have a magnetic field to protect it from cosmic rays and things like that. And D, you have no water. Is that a reasonable way? Sulfuric acid is minor, though. Give it an Earth ocean, you don't have sulfuric acid. You know, we got the same amount of sulfur in Venus, but it's dominated by the water. Sulfur dominates the chemistry of a planet from which you have removed the water. If there's water, the water dominates. And so on Earth, you have liquid water dominating. On Jupiter's moon Europa, which is covered by ice, you have ice dominating, and the sulfur is dissolved in the ice. On Venus, where you have no water, but it's hot, you have an atmospheric chemistry dominated by sulfur and sulfur compounds. On Io, the innermost of the four big moons of Jupiter, where there's no water, you have a surface chemistry dominated by solid sulfur compounds. Sulfur itself, sulfur dioxide, etc. And the reason is, when there's no water, sulfur will end up in the fall. Okay, so here's how you terraform Venus. First of all, you hit it with a few ice asteroids or comets at a glancing angle. This one speeds it up, speeds up the rotation, and two, introduce the water in the environment. You tailor yourself some organisms that will be able to do this kind of genetic engineering long before we're going to be able to engineer planets, so it's reasonable thoughts on that sort of thing. Tailor some organisms that can change carbon dioxide into oxygen and the dye in the oxygen level reaches a certain concentration, okay? And get rid of carbon dioxide by that way. Also, you might have some organisms in your oceans to rapidly, that are bred to rapidly turn carbon dioxide into calcium carbonate. And that gets rid of heat for you because when you get rid of carbon dioxide, you get rid of greenhouse. You might want to do something to the meteorology, which will give you a fairly extensive cloud cover of water droplets so that you keep the temperature down to a reasonable level. Because even without the greenhouse, you need to be close to the earth, close to the sun and earth, and therefore will be uncomfortably warm. And that's a very broad outline, you know. And obviously, it's not something we can do now, but it's something we may very well have the technical capability to do in a few centuries. I have this never done. I want to find a question way off.
If we need to space now. I'm
sorry? Exactly, exactly. And it's not only quicker, it'd be an awful lot more efficient. We're talking about space columns, as proposed by Gerardo Villa, which are made from small bodies, such as asteroids, where you need the entire volume of the body. If you terraform, and we have no idea that we can do it. It is not obvious that if we did something like that to Venus, that you wouldn't have something like destructive storms which are impossible to get rid of. You know, you got all that work to take centuries and you have a planet you live on anyway. It is by no means obvious that we can learn to manage the ecology and the meteorology and the climatology of the whole planet. We certainly don't have the knowledge now. We do not understand the climatology of Earth. We don't understand things like why there are ice ages. And we can't understand them, we certainly can't prevent them. So, space colonization, number one, is something we have the technology to do now, essentially now for 20 years. And number two is much more efficient because you're using the interior volume of all these bodies. If you terraform every terrestrial planet in the solar system, you would gain about 3 times the land area of Earth to live on. If you use all of the asteroids and smaller moons in the solar system, which nobody suggests doing, I'm just citing this number to show you, you know, how what the discrepancies are. You would have 3,000 times the land area of the Earth.
Yeah, I
had
4 lifespans.
Well, it's probably the same date. Most of the men I won't be able to do it for a while.
Next time,
Jupiter. Plus, a little follow-up for the Venus flight that didn't have enough space to reignite. Spectacular movies, by the way. If any of you are thinking of visiting Spring to Spring, yeah, check for the framework people who know the policies on that. But if you want to bring somebody to any lecture in this series, that's what I'm bringing to. Now, I don't know if there are still tickets, you know, people getting left. I think you probably are. I think you probably want to see people by occasion. That's what you think.
Well, I have seen photographs
of
that too,
growing
the
popular cast. Sure, but they didn't evolve it. I mean, life didn't originate under those circumstances. Life originated in much more benign circumstances by our consideration, and then evolved so that it could live in extreme environments. Well, there isn't any evidence of the sulfuric acid of ocean on really Earth. There's not enough sulfuric acid, but once there's not enough sulfur to go around. You know, you take all the material that causes the Venus and, you know, change temperature, change the pressure such that it can form a liquid on the surface, and you don't have an ocean. You have a life for a mile there. This is what you have. You know, only tens of millions, hundreds of millions of tons of matter in all the cars we get. And that's the ratio, that's the aligned portion of sulfur that one has decided to get given the carbon abundance. The only reason the government gets for energy is causing them to create a mighty fault, is that the water isn't there. Well, that's the question we, you know, discussed at the latest class, and I'm sure they do. There are two possibilities. One, these ones that hadn't lost. Two, these that have had time to form this matter different from here. Either, unfortunately, plausible in terms of favor or not. I think the more plausible one is the lack of the human form of the matter that we're close to the sun and the earth, therefore have less water than temperature. Water well. But we do know from the argon data, from the specificity of some people argon, you can do it in the earth, there's at least one difference in the matter that you want to form from. But please note that difference. Is in the primeval matter left over, not secondary stuff, the stuff that underwent chemical reactions and made up the overwhelming bulk of the planet. And the amount of those substances in the atmosphere, aside from the water, is very similar to that on Earth. What's interesting, of all the substances, water is a lot of water. So you can believe that the water is boiled off and the other stuff in the atmosphere. That's curious. I think you were here last time, I think you're right.
Oh,
I didn't
hear you. I didn't even see you ask the question. Okay, well, that's a good question. Yeah.
Five comparisons. What temperature is that?
Well, I don't think it does. That was a human. You could have little droplets of sulfur in the lower parts of the crust. I did not know that it was in Earth.
I did have a high school chemistry
course. Now there's never sulfur in an older person.
I can remember it. Yellow, bright yellow.
It's not that.
Change? I see. Okay, I'm totally out of my depth. I can't answer your question.
Plants doesn't know what it's saying, right? About 1% of the sunlight that hits the clouds off.